Broadcasting from the Mono Wind Casino Studios. This is Multicultural AM 1600 KGST Fresno.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermagerdichian. Today, my guest is Nanor Abalabanyan. She is the founder and director of the Hidden Road Initiative. Thank you for joining me today, Nanor.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we talk about the initiative that you're very much involved with, which I think is quite exciting, tell us a little bit about your background. Where were you born and a little bit about your family history?
I was born in 1990 in Aleppo, Syria. And the reason for that was because there was a civil war happening in Lebanon at the time. And my mom, who was in a bomb shelter, preferred having me somewhere a little bit more safe, because back where she was in Ashrafieh, Lebanon, the bombing was a lot. And so my dad came one night and said, "Sevan, let's get in the car and go to Syria where our family is." And they went off to Syria and I was born. But when the war ended 4 months later, we said, "Let's go back." So my father took my mom back to Lebanon, to Ashrafieh, but the bombing started again. Which took us back to the bomb shelter for a few months until 1991, when the war ended. And in that time, we moved to Anjar, which is a small village in Lebanon where many Fresno Armenians are from. And I grew up in Anjar for 9 years. And I have to say those were the best years of my life. My entire childhood was there. My first memories were there, went to school there. I played with animals and trees and ants and flowers, and I just have so many great memories in Anjar. Anjar is also the place where the descendants of the Musadaghtis came to. And so I had a wonderful childhood with wonderful traditions, and the day where we called the Khach Day, where we eat the harissa, and where we did a lot of tomato paste and loli gichur, and just had really wonderful memories growing up in the farms and just pure village hospitality. And so the idea of villages always resonated with me from that age, because I grew up in it and I loved it. And I loved that everyone was Armenian, even though our country was Arab, but everyone in the town, everyone in the village was Armenian. And I felt so safe, so loved. And also in that time, we grew up very close to the Armenian Evangelical Boarding School, where my father, he was the principal of the Armenian Evangelical School and the pastor. And so the boarding school was attached, and I grew up very close to those kids. And so that idea also of boarding schools, I think, was kind of instilled in me from a young age, which I'll get to in a little bit. After 1999, we moved to Beirut, Amanos, and then 2005, we moved to Palo Alto, where my dad's job took him to be the pastor of the Armenian church in San Francisco. And then my parents moved to Fresno just 3 years ago, to the Pilgrim Armenian Church. But at that time, I decided to stay in Palo Alto and continue teaching there. And then I'd always wanted to move either to Anjar or to Armenia. And I knew I wanted to move to a village. It was going to be either in a village in Armenia or Anjar. And for years, I was having this debate where to move, when to move. I went to UC Santa Barbara, got my degree, went to Stanford, got my master's, taught for 8 years. And I always wanted to go every summer. And I did go every summer, but it wasn't enough. Finally, it was 2020, September 26th, I moved to Armenia.
And before you moved to Armenia, however, you'd already been visiting, you mentioned. And when was the first time you actually did visit Armenia?
The first time I visited Armenia was in 2000. I was only 10 years old. And then I went again at 13 years old when I was doing a theater performance with our Armenian Evangelical School in Beirut. And the year I fell in love with Armenia, though, was 2009, when I was 19 years old. I was a first-year UCSB student. And I went to be an intern with the AGBU summer program, and they placed me at the United Nations. However, that was mostly an office job, not very interesting, until I went to a village called Akhrator with a mentor of mine, and my life changed after that. Akhrator was completely hidden in the middle of nowhere with no access to markets, no doctors, no roads, no healthcare. The school was extremely in a difficult condition. The villagers had huge health issues, and that's when I fell in love with Akhrator. That's when Hidden Road Initiative started, because I had filmed a small video about Akhrator called The Hidden Road. And afterwards, I applied to a grant, and it became the Hidden Road Initiative. And then it grew even more to be a nonprofit that supported multiple villages that were all on the border, all hidden, and all under a variety of different socioeconomic difficulties. So that's how it all started, by that one trip in 2009.
And how many people live in that village of Akhrator?
Well, when I first started, 400 people lived there. Now there's about 200, 250. A lot of people left due to how difficult the conditions are.
And so you decided then, after visiting Armenia several times, that you wanted to do something a little bit more organized. So tell us how the Hidden Road Initiative got started in the organized sense.
So in the beginning, it was just a college project. It was to get a computer lab so that they can be a little more connected to the outside world, and the children could have a way to just get access to information and get 21st century skills to be able to go to college. But that was back in 2011. And then that project went really well. A lot of college students that helped me from Yerevan and the U.S. were very interested to continue. So they really pushed me to make it into a club. So it ended up being a student club. And then from a student club, it ended up being an NGO, because the members kept growing and they said, you know, Nanor, we love that this is all non-political, non-partisan, non-religious, non-sectarian, non-anything. And the Armenian group and the Armenian members were all from a variety of places. There was Barskahais, Hayastansis, Beirutsis, and they were all college students, mostly all women. And we also liked, I think, that factor where, you know, we were very young and we could decide things together as a group. We would fundraise everything on our own. We weren't necessarily sponsored by anyone or anything. It was all based on our fundraisers that we would do together. And so that worked out really well. And it kept growing and growing. And then we ended up applying to grants to do more kindergartens and renovate two kindergartens. We ended up getting a sponsor to help us renovate parts of the school in Akhrator. Then we ended up growing to become a summer camp every summer in different villages, and a lot more college students joined. And that's how we started having a lot more chapters and universities. Just now, actually, we have an interest in Fresno State. There's a few members who are interested to start our first chapter in Fresno. We already have existing chapters in UCSB, UCLA, UC San Diego. We used to have some other ones as well. So it's exciting. It keeps growing. And I think after the war, people have been even more involved. But one of the things I love about HRI, or Hidden Road Initiative, we abbreviate it as HRI, is because we are all young students or alumni, there's not a lot of bureaucracy and decisions get made together. And we try to support different causes that are related to education, but that, for example, if a college student has an idea and they're very passionate about something, if it fits within our mission, we try to find a way for that to happen if it also meets the needs of the village. And one of the other things I've loved is that as we've grown and since we've been consistent in the same villages that we go to, so many of our alumni that we helped that went to our camps and then got our scholarships to go to college now have come back and help us teach during the summer camps, help us lead, decide the next project. For example, right now, a few of the Akhrator students are involved with us to renovate their school. We applied to a grant together and we're waiting to see if Armenian Educational Foundation, AEF, might renovate the entire school. But that's one of the beauties of being in somewhere for a long time is the kids know you and the villagers know you and they trust you and you know them. And you can really see the growth of the kids over the last 10, 11 years.
And your group is not only Armenians, is that right? I mean, it was your friends of yours from college that initially also were involved?
Yeah, initially it was, like I said, we were a bunch of kids. I'm always embarrassed a little bit at the towards the beginnings of how young we were. But we were very passionate and dedicated and we got things done. And then as it grew, a lot more non-Armenians joined. One of our, like, for example, our treasurer is a Mexican-American, not Armenian at all. She was a UCSB student. She came to Armenia with us, fell in love, came twice, became our treasurer. And then we have another board member, Valeria Torres. She's also Mexican-American. We've had African-Americans, Asian-Americans. We've had just Malaysians, Chinese also joined these summer camps or renovation projects at any given time. So it's kind of grown to be more than just an Armenian thing.
Well, how was it when you first went to this village after you wanted to get it organized and you wanted to do a camp? I mean, were people receptive? Did you have to go through bureaucracy in Armenia or how did it take place in Armenia?
No. I mean, in the beginning, I think the looks I got mostly was, who's this 19-year-old girl coming to our village, organizing these renovation projects? It's very unlikely for a 19-year-old girl to be able to do construction projects on their own. It was very strange for them, and I think they didn't take me very seriously. And then once they saw that I was serious and committed and didn't just do this thing once, I kept coming and kept bringing groups, and they saw the impact of that on their kids, on their village. The trust was built. And I also learned their ways of knowing how to talk, because the village is very different than Yerevan. So you need to know how to deal, how to talk, how to not get played. And I think it was a learning curve for both ends, because they had to adjust to my culture and how different things are for us. But in the end, I mean, I call them my family now. I just called them for Christmas when I've stayed with them for New Year's and Christmas before. And they have become family. In fact, this last year was really difficult for me and for them. In particular, we're talking about Akhbratzor now, even though now we do many villages. But Akhbratzor, I think, is my closest one to my heart. All our villages that we support went through very, very, very much a huge difficulty this last year. Because, ironically, all the borders we supported also got really badly hit in this war. In the previous wars, they haven't been hit in 2016 or in before, but these ones, both Akhbratzor, which is right by Vartenis, and Shivanitzor, which is right by Merdi, were and are extremely under threat. In fact, they're now both frontline to the border versus before there was this kind of gap between us and Azerbaijan. But now, since Kazlajar was taken over, Akhbratzor is now literally on the border. So before we could take our interns and go up on hikes on the mountain of Akhbratzor, we can no longer do that. That mountain is Azerbaijan. And so the war made us closer, though. Like I was saying, we're family. We became closer because, unfortunately, many of our boys went off to fight from our schools that we know, our alumni, and then our kids' parents, fathers, etc. And our hardest thing was losing Hamo. Hamo was one of my dear students. In fact, he was the first student in 2009 to welcome me to Akhbratzor. In the movie that I told you that I made in 2009 called The Hidden Road, he was the first boy who welcomed me to Akhbratzor and showed me the way to the school. Hamo was killed just a month ago. We found him a month ago. He was killed earlier than that, and we couldn't find him for weeks. In the end, we only found his bones because the drone had striken him, and his body burned. so only his bones were discovered. Because Akhbator is so small, the village took it very difficult. It was extremely difficult. And I went to the funeral. I went to the Hokihankis. It was horrible. I've never seen anything harder in my life. So it's made us closer now, but because of a bad reason, I wish there was other reasons why we felt closer.
My guest today is Nanar Balabanyan. She's the founder and director of the Hidden Road Initiative. We've been talking about some of her activities in Armenia. We're going to take a quick break on All Things Armenian, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. My guest today is Nanar Balabanyan. And Nanar, we were talking about your organizing the summer camps and a little bit about the war. I want to come back to the war in just a few minutes, but can you just tell us the structure of the summer camps, how long they last, how many kids do you help, and how many of your staff are there?
The summer camps are meant to be educational summer camps for kids ages 3 to 18, although our alumni usually come too, so we end up having till 20, 21-year-olds sometimes. And we try to do classes that are not taught in the village and are also basically kind of like electives that they wouldn't be exposed during the year. We also try to make it so that the kids get exposed to a variety of career or different topics in colleges that they wouldn't necessarily be exposed to. So for example, from computer science to journalism to video editing, video or photography, to a very specific kind of art like using Cricut or weaving or things that necessarily are not taught in their schools. We try to aim to make sure that we teach those topics, and they're usually 2 to 3 weeks long, although usually it's 2 week long camps. And we stay in the village school, we sleep on the floor, we go to their houses during the day after school, we do village activities after we finish the camp. It's really fun. I really, really enjoy it. So in the mornings we teach, and in the afternoons we do a lot of cultural activities and getting to know the village.
And you pretty much have to bring...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you pretty much have to bring all your equipment, all the people in, right, to do that camp?
Yes. Yes, we have a huge equipment ready with us from our shower tent. We have 2 shower tents now where we heat up the water and shower in that tent, to our food, you know, everything from our stoves to our just anything you need to eat, to sleeping bags, to mattresses, to lamps, because electricity is limited in Akhrazor, for example. So it's like camping, but in a school. It's just wonderful.
And you've expanded that. You had expanded that to 4 cities, is that right? Or 4 villages?
Well, yeah, the camp primarily happened in Shivanitzor and Akhrazor. But we've also done a camp in Shushi, Artsakh. We've done a camp in Ditevan. But the main ones that happen yearly are Akhrazor and Shivanitzor, the original 2.
And you've done other projects. I mean, you have so many projects going on. Tell us a little bit about maybe 1 or 2 of the other favorite projects that you've been working on now with Hidden Road Initiative.
Yeah, one project that people can probably get involved in from their home is our online camps. This actually is funny how every curse has some kind of blessing. With COVID, we couldn't go to Armenia this last summer, so we did online camps through Zoom. And that went so well that the volunteers were like, well, why don't we do this every week? And I said, well, we could. So we started teaching English online every Saturday morning, our time from 8 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. And it's there 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., but our 8 a.m. And so we have, and it keeps growing. You know, initially it was for Akhrazor and Shivanitzor kids. Then we started including Artsakh kids and some other kids from other villages. And now we have so many students, about 30 plus students that come weekly. And then we have 30 plus teachers that come weekly. And the first half hour, we do Hayran Asiragan singing, which means Armenian just patriotic songs that we all grew up with. We try to hit songs that usually would speak to the kids' hearts. So based on the mood, it's interesting how much we went through together since June. You know, in June, we were singing these patriotic songs because we all know them and love them. And then September hit, and all of a sudden now we're in war and singing these songs. And then there's a while when we couldn't sing songs because, you know, we had deaths that happened, or people's family members who didn't come back, or we didn't know where they were. And then we hit Christmas and New Year's. And so it's just, it's interesting how that singing changes throughout the months that we've been together. Now 6 months, wow. And after the 30 minutes of singing, we put them in breakout rooms one-on-one with their teacher. And they do 1 hour of English. And then during the week, the teacher on their own sets up a time to also meet with their student one more time. So the student ends up having twice a week English lessons, which we really, now that we've done this for 6 months, the kids we started with, we really see some huge growth. You'd be surprised.
So people can actually sign up with you, and then you would organize these meetings where they could speak to directly with the child. Is that right?
Correct. They apply on tinyurl.com/ArmeniaTutoring. That's tinyurl.com/ArmeniaTutoring. And we have a long wait list right now, though. We have so many, like I think 200 people who signed up to teach. So we're going through the wait list one by one now as more kids are being added. We're adding more teachers. And we'll, once it's your turn, we'll contact you and see if you're still interested. And we, you know, it's amazing how much it's growing. The more kids hear about it, even from Artsakh, so many more want to join, especially because learning English is so important right now. It's if they want to get a good job in Yerevan, or if they want to get any kind of international job, they need to know the language. And a lot of times the schools don't really prepare them. So having free English lessons is very attractive to many kids. Unfortunately, a lot of the village kids don't have access to technology, so we're still working on trying to figure out how we can provide them with internet and laptops or a phone to join. But that is the problem we're trying to fix and work on.
So you said that you had been traveling back and forth, and then when was it that you made the decision to kind of move, I'm going to say permanently, but at least for the near future, to Armenia?
When did I just make the decision?
Yeah, huh?
It was January of this year. So it was a year ago, exactly, January 2020. I decided that this was going to be the year. I was going to turn 30. And I had always heard from God that this is what I needed to do. And I really just felt like I was following my calling. And, you know, it was interesting. I had this big job opportunity in August to work in LA. And I did, and it was a really big opportunity, but I also felt in my heart that I really needed to go. I could hear from God, you need to go, you need to go, you need to go. And so I left my other job. I quit, basically, and I went. And then the day after the war started, and I knew why God had sent me. And I also just feel like I'm happier overall in Armenia. I feel more alive in Armenia. I feel healthier in Armenia. My quality of life just feels better overall. I feel like I am where I need to be. So that it's a great feeling to be finally in a place where you feel like you really, really belong, even though I wasn't born there. I just, for me, it's just, I fit. It's like a Lego box that just fits.
And you're based in Yerevan. Is that where you're living now?
Well, the original goal when I moved was I was going to move to Akhbarastor, actually, to start a computer learning center where the kids would come and do classes and, you know, they would have access to technology and we can do our Zoom classes. And that was what was going to happen. So I moved to Yerevan thinking, okay, I'll take 2-3 weeks off, rest a little bit, and then I'll be off to Akhbarastor. And then the war started and I started working with refugees full time. So now I'm working with full-time shelters. I work with 14, I've been in charge of 14 shelters to provide them with education and volunteers. So basically kind of like Hidden Road summer camp, but for Artsakh refugees and shelters. And I've been doing that since I moved. Well, no, the first month that I moved, we only just provided food, healthcare, shelter. It was horrible. It was so horrible. I can't tell you. They would come with buses with barely anything. And our center that I worked in would just host them, find them housing, find them food, find them medicine. I can't tell you how difficult that was. And then after that, I got employed by Project Hope to be in charge of the shelters. So then after that, I became in charge of the educational component. And now I love my job. I do love working with Artsakhis because the need is really great. And so I think at the moment I should
stay focused on Artsakh and the refugee crisis that we have. But I think eventually I'll be back in Akhbarator.
And these are the, even before the war started, these were displaced persons or people that were coming, or was this all after the September 27th war?
Oh, no. Of course not. No, Artsakhis would never leave their homes. Artsakhis are the most proud Armenians you'll ever meet. They have many children. Many of them, you know, are multi-member families because, you know, people who move to Artsakh or people who live in Artsakh are ones who have been defending our homeland with their blood and life and family. And so they're very, very nationalistic in terms of being attached to their land, to their people. They would never leave their home. We never expected this to happen. September 27 happened. I thought it was at first, before we've had a war for four days. But this was a genocide. I mean, I know academics don't call it that, but in many ways there were genocidal things that happened culturally. Our churches, our homes, our monuments, our artifacts, our statues, you name it, were destroyed. And with my own eyes, I saw an entire, it was so difficult. It was the day that the Armenians had to officially leave Artsakh or parts of Artsakh. And I was there, and I was part of the group that had to leave Kalbajar. And it was so difficult. It took 15 hours to get out of Stepanakert and come to Yerevan. And I saw houses burned. I saw a school burned with my own eyes. And that, for me, was the hardest thing I've seen in Armenia so far, or actually in my life. I wept like a child seeing an Armenian school that was recently renovated, it looked like, being burned with their desks and chairs and textbooks. And I went in that fire. The moment I saw the fire go on, I told the car to stop. I ran to the school up this hill. I got into the fire. I literally felt like I was going mad. I really did. I went in the fire and saved any book I could. And I brought whatever I could with me back to Yerevan. But to me, that was really hard. It took me back to all the stories of Zaruhi that she would tell me, and Balaban Khoja, my great-grandparents, of what they experienced and what they left behind. And then after seeing all that and saying goodbye to the church that we had to leave, to the Azeris, which was also really difficult, because I saw khachkars being taken off with people's own hands, people saving any piece of the church they could because the next day was going to be Azerbaijan. After seeing all that and the houses burned and all of that, then I had to be in basically the caravan that took 15 hours, where thousands of Armenians were being kicked out of their homeland to go into Armenia. And I was in that caravan, and people's entire homes were on the top of their cars, on the top of their trucks, on the top of whatever they could find. And these are people who could afford it. Many could never go back to actually get their stuff. And on this road, 15 hours long with thousands of people, the cars didn't move. It was freezing cold. It was almost midnight. We were still on the mountain in snow, not moving, and all scared to death that at midnight the land was going to be Azerbaijan and we didn't know what was going to happen to us. It was extremely stressful. Eventually at 4 a.m., I think the road opened and we left. But until then, people were cutting wood so they can heat up and started fires on the road, people crying. It was a mess. There was no reception. Everybody was scared to death. And one more thing that was hard is because all that land was going to be Azerbaijan the next day, any Armenian that had a saw was on the road cutting trees to take it to Armenia with them because they were going to give the land and they wanted to take anything they could from their land before they give it to the Turks, kind of like other scorched earth policy. That's it. I'm a history teacher. I just never thought I would ever in my entire life ever see anything as horrible as what I did. on that night. I don't know. I've seen many things. I've lived through the Lebanon War. My family went through the Syrian War. But what I saw in the last 3 months in Armenia is unbelievable. And the fact that the world just stood and watched, I just don't have any words.
Yeah,
I don't.
It was a very difficult time for people, there, of course, experiencing it. And then for the people throughout the diaspora, just not understanding, just what was happening. It was a very difficult period. My guest today is Nanar Balabanyan. She is the director and founder of the Hidden Road Initiative. We've been talking about various of her projects. We're going to take another brief pause on All Things Armenian, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Demirgardichian. My guest today is Nanor Balabanya, and she is working with the Hidden Road Initiative. She was discussing before the break about the tragic events of the war in Artsakh that took place between September 27th and November the 9th or 10th, when the statement or agreement that stopped the fighting took place. After that, you were also working at some clinics or hospitals. Were you not helping some of the soldiers who had been injured in the war?
Yeah, besides working with the shelters, in the mornings I would do shelter work, and evenings I would go to hospitals, and still do. I took my dog with me to Armenia, and my dog has just been a really wonderful therapy dog to the kids I worked in America with, because I lived in a boarding school in America with children who had a variety of different issues back at home, and they would live in the boarding school. And in our boarding school, Coco did really good work with the kids, with the girls. He would just provide a lot of comfort and emotional support. And so when the war began, and there was a while that the shelters that I was working in closed, or I couldn't work there because of COVID, there was a lull in time, and I said, well, why don't we try going into hospitals? Because Coco did such good work with refugees. Maybe Coco can help the soldiers. And at first, when I presented the idea to the doctor, you know, it was very strange. What, an animal in a hospital? And I said, you know, it happens in America all the time, and Coco's done a lot of this kind of work. Why don't you let him come and you'll see the effect? And from the first day that Coco went into Wigmore Clinic, oh my goodness, everyone fell in love, doctors, nurses, soldiers. And so from there, Coco became Armenia's first animal hospital therapy dog. Coco became the first therapy dog in a hospital in Armenia. And he just became a star. Everyone loved him. And the soldiers really benefited from his presence. So that was just really nice. And we still go, and the soldiers wait for Coco. And we take books with us and art with us. And so it ended up being from Coco therapy to books, to letters, to music, to art. And all these kinds of therapies just come with us now. And it all started with Coco, my dog.
So there are a lot of soldiers who are still recovering, recuperating. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, that's another painful part. I don't even know what part to tell you without getting too emotional.
Just a lot of that there are soldiers who were severely injured, right? And that they're just trying to recover and trying to get back to some sense of normalcy, I suppose.
Yes, but the reason it's hard for me to even get words is because we as a country, as a world, have never seen this type of injuries ever, because we've never fought this type of war. Drone warfare was never seen before until now, not on this level. I mean, of course, drone attacks were used by the United States on a variety of different missions, or other countries had used it. And it was used in Libya, but this type or this level and this amount of drones were never used. So as a world, we never saw anything like this. How does that relate to the hospitals? Well, most of the guys who are in the hospital are all drone-based attacks, soldiers who were attacked in drones. And it's a complete miracle they're alive, complete, almost every one of them. The guys that come out of this war are literally living miracles. We don't know the official estimates of death toll. We believe it's around 5,000. And the guys who've come back have a variety of issues, from amputees. Like, there's lots of amputees because I think the medical field was also not ready for this war. So a lot of times when they weren't ready, sometimes they would amputate. And, you know, in another case, maybe that could have been saved if there was another doctor, but that's a different story for another time. From amputees to mental wards, where there's a huge mental health issue right now. Soldiers experience things they've never seen. I mean, it's kind of like in World War II when Blitzkrieg happened and new type of warfare was used. The world had never seen anything like it. And so, you know, now it's the same kind where our guys went off to fight with their guns and they were being attacked with drones from the top. And a lot of times the soldiers, when I talk to them, tell me, Nanod, it's like rain. You know, there's no point in me being there with a gun because it rained. Drones would rain on us, they would say. So the fact that they're alive is a miracle. But many of them have come back with, like I said, no arm, no leg, difficulty walking, difficulty just, for many, it's just emotional, being able to, like, for example, I take them books and letters to read. Many of them can't finish the letter because they're shaking or they can't concentrate. It's horrible.
Yeah, you've lived through a very, very historic period, and I hope that you write down these thoughts, because I think that they would be important to look back on and as a documentation of what took place from a different perspective as well. I want to go back to the Hidden Road Initiative. You also have a scholarship program. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing with the scholarship program.
Yeah, the scholarship program started from an idea of one of our friends who was with us one summer and said, Nanor, you know, I noticed a lot of these kids aren't going to college. And I said, yeah, it's mostly financial issue and this and that. And they said, well, why don't we start a financial scholarship program? And so, again, it started with a college student idea, as a lot of great ideas start with. Even though people take them for being too idealistic. And since then, we've been able to support every student that applies full or half scholarships to go to college. And it's encouraged a lot of women to go, because a lot of times women just get married off, especially from the villages. It's encouraged a lot of other older people who didn't really go to college right after high school to go back to school. And I'm just really happy and proud about this program, because it's really, really helped many, many women and men to go to college or go back to college and finish their degrees.
And the focus
and how it works is,
yeah, go ahead.
Huh? Yeah, how it works is you go online, you pick a student that you want to sponsor, and usually I like people to consistently sponsor them for 4 years if possible, but you don't have to. The tuition is not a lot. Maximum, it's $1,000 a year, maximum. And so, and I usually tell people, if that's too much, why don't you find someone that you can split the scholarship with and you become their sponsor. And during the year, if you want, the student writes to you updates and sends you letters, and you get to kind of establish a relationship, which I think a lot of times is one of the best things about our program is the relationships, because we're not too big of a program. We really focus on these two villages specifically and develop really, really strong rooted relationships. And scholarships are just one of the ways that you get to really, really know the student and make an impact in their life.
And they are pursuing all different types of education, right? In terms of the colleges they attend,
right,
their career goals.
Yes, all types, from tourism. We have a lot of girls who do tourism. We have women lawyers. We have computer scientists. We have a psychologist, a librarian. It's so interesting, the majors they pick. It's a variety of different ones.
And so you're planning to stay for a while then, right? I mean, I'm not asking you for a specific period, but you'll be in Armenia for the foreseeable future, right?
I mean, I hope my mom's not listening, but I'm not planning to come back.
Okay. She'll hear that later.
I love it there. No, I don't want to come back. I really don't. I don't believe I should. I really do believe for Armenia, especially now that we're so much under threat, this is my personal opinion and it might come off strong, but I truly believe every Armenian needs to be in Armenia. And if they're not, then they have to contribute a huge amount of their finances to Armenia. if they want to see their country continue. Because I've never seen, again, I know these are very opinionated and people have different views, but if we want our country to survive, we need all hands on deck. And this last war should be a warning for all of us and how unprepared and weak we were, both militarily and with our arms. And, you know, I'm not talking politically, just in general, we were weak. We could have been taken over with a snap. And so I truly believe that every Armenian needs to be hands on deck, either living in Armenia and fully contributing, or if they're living abroad, they need to contribute financially to trusted organizations, or trusted anyone trust that they trust to continue building, because we're very, very fragile. So no, I do not plan to come back ever.
So the projects that you're involved with included the summer camps, scholarships, renovations, and what do you see now in, let's say, is maybe the next 6 months or the next year as one of the top priorities for your organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'll talk more personally, and then I don't know, as an organization, I have to talk to the board, because I do a lot of things outside the organization too. I think for me personally, my top thing that I envision and need to see is strengthening of our border villages and strengthening of, which now would be Artsakh as well. Our borders are under threat. We are surrounded by enemy from all sides of Armenia. And if we don't strengthen the villages, we don't strengthen, and I'm not just talking militarily, I'm talking more like, but you either, whether it's through simple morale boost of the village, to strengthening the schools, to equipping the villagers with their basic needs and beyond basic needs, hopefully that they actually thrive and stay there. But to me personally, education I see as a big weapon. And for me, what I see myself working on for the next 6 months is solely educational projects on border villages, whether it's the ones that I work in or Artsakh. And I don't even think it's a weather or thing. I think it's both. It's just now I have to figure out the strategy of how we're doing this, and what specific educational needs they need that are most important and urgent in keeping the villagers in the village and also helping them feel safe. And also just, I think the moral part, the emotional part of it is just knowing that there's people behind them. Because I think a lot of times when you're in a village, let alone in Armenia, you feel like you're forgotten and people don't care and you're on your own. Especially, I think in Armenia now, a lot of border villages feel that way because so much attention is going on Artsakh and Artsakhis, that a lot of our kids and villages feel alone and isolated. So I see my next 6 months focusing on that, on village empowerment through education.
And tell us how listeners can get involved. Where can we go to learn more about the Hidden Road Initiative?
Yeah, we can always check out our website, hiddenroadinitiative.org. And we have a Facebook and Instagram. We update very often, I think more often than our website. So on Facebook, it's Hidden Road Initiative. On Instagram, it's at Hidden Road Initiative. And my Instagram is also updated almost every other day, at Nano, B-A-L, Nano Bal. And both these websites, you will see weekly, if not biweekly, updates. And for involvement in projects, so we would love to have your support in the scholarship program or in our next 6 months. I don't know what it's going to look like yet. I think I'm going back to have a meeting and seeing if we're going to start a computer lab, if we can expand our computer program, if we can continue our online English Zoom classes, which really, really is part of the village empowerment. Because like I said, if the kids know how to speak another language, it opens up a huge amount of opportunities for them from wherever they're living.
so they can stay in their village while doing jobs, while doing work, while studying. So supporting us to buy more laptops would be really helpful, and hotspots for internet. And you can do all that by just going online to donate. But I think more than anything, just we'd appreciate your prayers, and that you continue thinking about Armenia and keeping us in your thoughts and prayers. And I think that also means a lot, is just knowing that we're not forgotten.
My guest today has been Nanor Balabanyan. She's the founder and director of the Hidden Road Initiative. And we discussed all kinds of things about what's been happening in Armenia. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nanor.
Thank you, Professor Barlow. I'm so honored to be here.
For All Things Armenian, this is Professor Barlow Demirgadishian wishing you a good week, and we'll be seeing you next week for another edition of All Things Armenian.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.